Good morning and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you.
Yeah. I'm Dr. Gay Carlson, president of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, with one of my screenside chats for our ACAP members. Screenside chats, as some of you know, are meant to share timely clinical practice and other information for our members on key topics during the COVID-19 pandemic continuing to plague us. Reminiscent of President Roosevelt's fireside chats, he didn't have screens, lucky him. Reminiscent of President Roosevelt's fireside chats during the Great Depression and World War II, I'm hoping they'll be informative and comfortable and fill a niche not otherwise addressed by materials we have at ACAP. We're lucky today to be talking to Dr. Joan Luby. She's the Samuel and May S. Ludwig Professor of Psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine, director and founder of the Early Emotional Development Program. She's been studying preschool depression for 30 years. It's a long time. And with her neuroscience colleague, Dr. Deanna Bartsch, has demonstrated neural correlates and effects on brain development into adolescence. She's authored numerous papers on these topics and has ongoing federal grants that are now investigating the prenatal and infancy effects on neurodevelopment and risks for future psychopathology. So Joan, preschool depression took a long time before the field was able to begin to come to grips with that. Why? Why do you think?
I mean, I think the field is still coming to grips with it, to be honest. But I mean, as you well know from your landmark paper with Denny Cantwell, Unmasking Mass Depression, there's been the assumption for a very, very long time that children couldn't get depressed, or that if they did, they wouldn't express the core manifestations of depression. And while in the 80s, you guys showed and people began to accept that children 6 and older could be depressed, I think it was just a bridge too far to think that children younger than 6 could be depressed, because there are sort of two core false assumptions, I think. One is that children younger than 6 are very emotionally unsophisticated. They can't experience complex emotions like guilt or shame or anhedonia. And that they're so inherently joyful that we just think they're too young to experience this type of depressive affect. But contrary to those assumptions and our wishes, unfortunately, that's not really true. And we had to provide a lot of evidence, including longitudinal data, I think, to demonstrate that.
So what does a prototypic, we have this thing about you've seen one, you've seen them all, but that's not really true. But how would you alert our colleagues to what preschool depression looks like?
Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things that's tricky is that it doesn't make itself very, very clear. You sort of have to look for it. So depressed preschoolers, so often are not going to come to the attention of teachers, and they're not going to come to the attention of parents, because if they're depressed and don't have a comorbid disruptive disorder, they don't, get in trouble in school, they don't bother people. But if you look closely, you find that these are kids who are anhedonic. They're not experiencing joy. They're not enjoying activities and play in the same way that other kids, that their peers are. They also experience a lot of guilt. So this is something that clinicians don't always ask about, asking parents how children respond to transgressions. I mean, parents often will report that children do things wrong and they deny it, or they blame other kids, or they don't feel bad about it. But depressed preschoolers, in contrast, feel excessive guilt. And they often are very hard to reassure. They might feel guilty the next day. They might take responsibility for transgressions that are not their own. And some of these emotions are experienced more quietly and internally. So I think the two key things to look at are the presence of anhedonia, which doesn't have to be occurring 24/7. It just has to be occurring, you know, many hours a day, many days of the week, where a child doesn't want to go out and play with friends, doesn't want to engage in activities they used to enjoy. And then the presence of excessive guilt. Those are two things that are going to be highly specific to depression. Although it can also have other features like irritability, general negativity, low self-esteem, and then disturbances in sleep and appetite.
So the change, I mean, one of the hallmarks, I think, of a mood disorder in children and adults is a change that you haven't been that way for your whole life, and that right. for whatever reason, you know, that there you look back and you say, gee, you know, so and so used to love to play with, I don't know, Mary or Joe or whoever it is, or, you know, if she was having a bad day, we could go get an ice cream and that would perk her right up, and now, you know, that doesn't really happen. Are those the kind of things you're looking at?
Yes, those are the kinds of things I'm looking at. And the ice cream narrative is a good one, because there's also, it's the inability to brighten. So, of course, every kid gets sad. Every kid sometimes feels transiently low. But younger kids, it tends to be transient. And they brighten when they're given an ice cream. You know, probably 95%. Ice cream does the trick. But depressed kids are not, that's not going to work.
You mentioned the paper that I did with Denny Cantwell. Many people no longer know Dr. Cantwell, but he was one of the big researchers in the area of ADHD and also mood disorders, and he was my mentor. Anyway, he used to talk about the positive Disneyland sign. We were in California at the time. He said, if you took a kid to Disneyland and they didn't cheer up, they were probably depressed.
Absolutely.
So that's important then, the specific markers that clinicians should look for. You mentioned that you've had to work, and you have had to work, no question about it, Joan. I think it has been, it's not been an easy sell. What are the longitudinal implications? What is the validity to this? Because when you think about any condition, you've got the short-term problems of it, and it, even if it doesn't continue into the future, even if it doesn't have, you know, prognostic implications, you feel bad at the moment. So if you have a terrible head cold, obviously, you know you're not going to die from it. You know you're going to be better in a couple of weeks, but you feel awful. And, you know, you want to do something to alleviate the symptoms. So there's the short-term, you know, obligation you have. But like what we have with COVID now, it isn't just a matter of that you feel like, you know, horrible. It's that you don't know when the next shoe is going to drop. You don't know if you're going to be one of the people that ends up having long-term problems with it, or you're going to be able to fight it and get over it. So what are the long-term implications of depression in preschool kids?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually, I think, a really, really critical question. And one of the things that in the research environment in my department, which is actually Denny Cantwell, is from St. Louis and
yes.
spent time in my department, I really had to prove using sort of biological and brain-based factors the validity of this disorder, which, of course, originally frustrated me, but now I'm very thankful for. One of the reasons why I think preschool depression is so critically important, even if you don't care that much about preschoolers, is because it has long-term implications for adaptive outcomes, developmental outcomes, and brain outcomes. And so what we found when we've followed this sample of over 300 kids now for almost 17 years is that if you had an episode of preschool depression, not only are you more at risk to have later episodes of depression during childhood and adolescence, clearly, like the adolescent or adult disorder, it's chronic and recurring. We also know that even when you've recovered from that episode of preschool depression, and even in cases where maybe you don't even have another episode, your brain development is altered by it. We know that there's a very different pattern of cortical thinning when you in children who've had episodes of preschool depression. So what it seems to imply is that the experience of having depression during the preschool period, which is a time when there's very significant brain change and still what we call neuroplasticity, actually impacts the trajectory of brain development in ways that are associated with negative outcomes. Certain regions are smaller, like the hippocampus. Smaller hippocampus tends to be associated with problems in cognitive functioning. So it's almost like the experience of a prolonged episode of preschool depression sort of has a toxic effect on the brain that then doesn't go away entirely later in development. The other reason why I think it's so important to identify depression in the preschool period is because we know it's not that easy to treat later in development. There's a high group of people who are treatment resistant. So while we have many effective treatments, it's not one of those, it's not a slam dunk. And the idea is that we might have a window of opportunity to treat it more effectively earlier.
You know, one of the things that I imagine is probably really difficult to answer, but as you're talking about the differences, how do you know that it isn't the fact that those kids have those neural changes that predisposes them to depression? So sort of chicken and egg kind of thing. Yeah. They had that to begin with, and that the depression is the consequence of it rather than the depression is what causes it.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, and I can't be sure of that. I mean, the one piece of evidence that would argue against that is that family history of depression does not have that same effect, and that this effect persists even when we control for family history of depression. So while that doesn't definitively solve this chicken and egg problem, it does suggest that it's not based on a genetic predisposition.
What would you, so two clinical questions, what are the comorbidities that are most common? I think that one of the reasons that externalizing disorders are externalizing is they do grab your attention, okay, which internalizing disorders don't. Again, to quote my friend Denny Cantwell, I get must be the St. Louis influence, Joan. But anyway, he used to talk about onion disorders and garlic disorders being the externalizing and the onion disorders being the internalizing. So what are the comorbidities that are more likely, I think, to grab a parent's attention or a preschool teacher's attention than just noticing that the child isn't enjoying his ice cream as much as he used to?
First of all, I love that metaphor because I think cooking metaphors are just really, really pertinent in science. So I'm gonna use that one going forward. The comorbidities are really similar to those in school age kids. You know, something like 45% of depressed preschoolers also have comorbid ADHD or ODD. Of course, comorbid anxiety disorders are also very common in depressed preschoolers. So it does tend to be a highly comorbid disorder, and I think it's much more common that the comorbidity is what captures clinical attention, and then the depression is eventually uncovered after the comorbidity is uncovered.
And screening measures. I know you've developed a measure called the Preschool Feelings Checklist. Is that a good screening measure? Is that something that you would put in a screening packet, you know, the way people are using the PHQ or the Child Behavior Checklist or the Vanderbilt or whatever it is to do a thorough evaluation? Would you put the Preschool Feelings Checklist in there? Is there something else that you would recommend in the way of screening measure?
Yeah, no, I certainly would put the preschool feelings checklist in there. And we're arguing to do that currently, as you know, from, you know, using some data that you guys have at Stony Brook and then using some of our own data in St. Louis. And the beauty of the preschool feelings checklist is that it's super short. It only takes about 2 minutes to fill out. I think it could be used in primary care settings and daycare and preschool settings very, very easily. And it really has pretty good specificity and sensitivity. So I don't see any reason not to use it. I think it captures kids who are at high risk and who would then be in need of a full evaluation. I think, and I don't know of any other measures that capture preschool depression. I wish there were, and I encourage people to develop them. I think that the problem that we have is that, you know, primary care clinicians don't like to screen for things that they then don't have the resources to treat. And so that...
Right. So that leave Pandora in her box, right?
Exactly. So that's where we run into trouble.
Okay. Well, so now that brings us up, obviously, to the question about, so, well, first of all, I guess to put in another plug with a preschool screen feelings checklist is, it was actually useful for things other than depression. It really is a very nice little screening measure. So if you do have concerns that a child might be depressed, what does the evaluation look like? And then what do you do next so that the primary care docs won't say, let's let sleeping dogs lie?
Yeah, exactly. So the evaluation, you know, should sort of follow the guidelines of what a preschool mental health evaluation generally encompasses. And there have been sort of standards of practice for this, many that have been published in JCAP, although many, many years ago. But when we evaluate a preschool child, we tend to need to see the child on more than one occasion, to see the child with more than one caregiver, if possible, and also to see the child in a play context. So we do play evaluations where we observe the child playing with a primary caregiver for an extended period of time. We also sometimes use what we call semi-structured assessments, where we watch the child and caregiver play under a variety of different circumstances, having a snack after a brief separation or reunion, or engaged in a difficult, challenging task. Because sometimes that brings out some of the negative behaviors. So, I mean, it can vary in our own infant clinic at WashU. It's a 4-session eval. Many other centers, it's shorter. Some centers use a full half-day eval. But you would need an evaluation by a mental health clinician. I think that's more common now, but I'm sure that it's not available in every center.
But, you know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, well, maybe you can say a little bit about what that looks like with COVID and doing it remotely, because, you know, the other big thing that we look for in preschool kids these days is autism. And that does also have a, when I say structured, I mean that there are things that you look for systematically, and there are props that you use, or presses, or stimuli, or you know, whatever words you want to use to try to elicit those kinds of things. And that's what it sounds like you're talking about. So what would you, how might you do this actually if you're doing it remotely?
Well, we've been embarking on that.
Sure you have.
Yes, which we hope to discontinue pretty soon. But basically using Zoom, as we're doing today, you know, we get a camera into the child's home, and we basically have the parent and child set up a play scenario. This requires a certain amount of instructions to the parent prior to the session, where they sit with the child with the camera on them, with the child's favorite toys, and we watch them engage in play. It's a little bit harder to use the pressers under those circumstances, but I think some of my colleagues have done that fairly successfully. It's much easier to do that in a clinic where you can control the conditions, but it is theoretically possible that you could train the parent to engage in certain types of tasks via Zoom. And so we have been doing evaluations via Zoom. I feel pretty good about them. They're not the same as an in-person evaluation, obviously. On the other hand, you do get a sense of the child's home environment, and it's probably more ecologically valid. So there are some advantages to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had the same sort of conflict, and I go back and forth on which I despair with. And I mean, do I want to talk to somebody with my goggles and a mask on, and they've got a mask on, and I'm sitting 6 feet away from them, and oh, don't touch me! Oh my God! is that what I want, or do I want to be in home where the kid, you know, gives me 5 seconds of attention on screen and then rushes off and does something else, and then in order to get him back, we get a 5+ temper tantrum, and you know, okay, fine. So I know the kid has a temper tantrum, but really, you know, after about 30 seconds of a temper tantrum, you really don't learn a lot. So, you know, it is definitely challenging. So tell us about so in terms of treatment, I'm aware of your PCIT for depressed children. I assume that's one of the top treatments. Tell us about that.
So that is a form of parent-child psychotherapy that's an adaptation of parent-child interaction therapy, which is a really well-validated form of treatment that's empirically proven, that's been around in the literature since the 1970s, developed by psychologist Sheila Iber. What we did is we used the techniques that are used in that treatment, which I find very compelling, and that is that there's live in vivo coaching. So the way it's set up is that the parent and child come into the clinic, they engage and play together. The therapist is watching them through a one-way mirror, and the parent has a bug in the ear, and they're being coached by the therapist. So what that does is enables the therapist to coach the parent live while interacting with the child during stressful conditions. And I think for that reason, it's much more effective. It also has what's called a teach and coach approach. So first you train the parent on how to interact differently with the child, and then you coach them through it. What we did is we used those fundamental techniques to develop what we call the emotion development module. And that's geared towards helping the parent enhance the child's emotional competence. So to help the parent tolerate the child's expression of intense emotions, to help the parent serve as the child's external emotion regulator and coach. And we do things like induce guilt in the clinical setting and then coach the parent for how the child can more adaptively respond to a transgression. So it has those types of components. The beauty of it is that it can be delivered by a master's level clinician. It takes about 18 sessions to complete, which is a lot, but it's a lot shorter than 2 years. And it has been shown to have powerful effect sizes over 1.0, as well as resulting in brain change. That is, we looked at EEG in response to reward scenarios, and we saw that after the treatment, treated children's reward response had normalized and looked more like normal children. So we were feeling pretty confident about it, and it basically is sort of targets the parent-child relationship, tries to enhance the parent-child relationship, and tries to enhance the child's emotion development.
So the flip implication for that is somehow it's the parent's fault. If you're correcting the relationship, must be something wrong with the relationship. How do you get around that in terms of eliminating the guilt induction?
Yeah, very clearly. I mean, it is not the parent's fault. So, I mean, just like any kind of psychiatric condition where parenting might help improve the condition, that doesn't mean it's the cause of the condition. So the way we approach it is we kind of say this child has some problems with their emotion processing that make it harder for them to parent. It requires different types of parenting interventions. So we want to train the parent almost to interact with the child using techniques that a play therapist would, to try to help the child grow out of or develop away from those habits. And the beauty of training the parent is that then this gets enacted in their daily interactions 24/7, right, as opposed to just meeting with a therapist once or twice a week.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of play therapy, would just plain old play therapy help?
That's a really good question. You know, I mean, I feel good about play therapy. Of course, as you and I both know, it so depends on that play therapist and the quality and savvy of that play therapist. But I think a good play therapist who is attentive to a child's emotion processing and emotion regulation, as long as they were interfacing with the parent and working to change the home environment, I think that could be helpful. I think the next study really should probably be a head-to-head comparison of those two things.
Yeah. I think, having taken a PCIT workshop and being old enough to have been had some training in play therapy, I think the PCIT is easier to teach and structure, and you have a little more control over it, whereas, you know, the play therapists that I've learned from, some of them were really amazing.
Yeah.
And they were amazing because they were amazing. I couldn't be those people.
Exactly.
And some of them were not worth much. So it's a much more ad feminem or ad hominem kind of a thing, I think, with the open-ended. So as child and adolescent psychiatrists, one of the questions people are going to want to know is that what if any place is there for medication in managing children, preschool children with mood disorder?
Yeah, that is the central question that I always get. And I guess if there's any message that should come across today, I would say one thing that is very, very clear, that it is absolutely not the first line of treatment. So it's something, it is, you know, the antidepressants have not been tested in preschool children. We don't know if they're safe and we don't know if they're effective. We do know they're safe and effective for children 6 and older or 7 and older, wherever those studies began, but they have not been tested in preschool children. In my own clinical experience, and I'm interested in what yours is, you know, the use of antidepressants, SSRI antidepressants, is a lot trickier in preschool children because they have much higher rates of activation. And so even in other conditions where they're more indicated, the side effects are more problematic. So I would say I have certainly treated depressed kids with antidepressants, but those are only kids who really have very severe depressions that are not fully remediated after therapy. After play therapy.
And did it do any good?
Yes. Yes. It did do some good.
Yeah. See, I think one of the difficulties that we've had with school age kids, with whom I'm more familiar, is the data on antidepressant effectiveness in that age group doesn't knock your socks off either. Of course, you know, we use the tricyclics in the beginning, and they, you know, the meta-analysis after meta-analysis torturing the same data still came up with it wasn't effective. And with SSRIs, I think, you know, we've got Graham Emsley's original data, and whether that's positive because it was a smaller, more controlled sample, and it's the fact that there are a lot of things you can't control in drug studies or not. The fact is, drug study after drug study after drug study seems to not be positive in children, whereas with adolescents, you get a better response. So just sort of extrapolating from that, the mass data aren't encouraging. And I think the smaller data, in other words, replicating a Graham study with younger children, you know, might be worthwhile doing. But as you say, you're treading. This isn't a common problem. This isn't a rampant problem, right? I mean, if you were to say the frequency here, this is not epidemic. But so it, you know, it would be hard. It's been hard enough, I think, to get samples of kids even into the school age depression study. I think doing any kind of systematic medication trial in preschool kids would really be difficult to do.
I think it'd be very, very difficult at both socially, and I just don't think the field would be accepting of that or ready for that, and there'd be a lot of concerns, you know, as we're raised in the whole pediatric psychopharmacology crisis. But let me say a couple things. One is the prevalence rate in preschoolers is about the same as in school age kids, which is 2%. When we did this treatment trial of the PCITED and we had about 280 kids, I had a full-time study recruiter who literally spent 40 hours a week going out into the community, beating the bushes, trying to find kids, because it is a low prevalence disorder. So you, if you're going to study the disorder, you've got to really, really dig for these kids. So that's the other caveat that makes the research more difficult.
Good. Well, I think our time is about up. I really appreciate your being with us this morning. I appreciate the work that you've done, Joan. I think it was groundbreaking, very heroic and brave on your part. And I think you've done a real service to the profession. So thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
And thank you all of our viewers, and tune in for our next session. Bye-bye.
Thank you all very much for tuning in. This is Gay Carlson for ACAPS Screenside Chats.